Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow here, and I am very thrilled to be speaking today with our director, Jeremy Zettelmeyer, and Oya Chelasun, who is joining us from the International Monetary Fund. She is the deputy director of the European Department and oversees work on EU and EU economics. And we are all going to talk today about European competitiveness. German, could you help our listeners understand why competitiveness is such a hot topic today and what it means for the EU?
So I think competitiveness has been a hot topic for the EU for some time, but it is a hotter topic now than it was before because the EU is being challenged on so many fronts. It's being challenged by decarbonization, which requires investments and raises costs for firms through carbon pricing. It's being challenged on energy security and economic security more broadly. So the pandemic has brought home the potential risks that come from being very open and trade dependent. And it's being challenged by economic nationalism and protectionism in competitor countries, in China, of course, but also in the US since Trump, and basically also in the Biden administration through things like the Inflation Reduction Act. What is, I think, important in this context is to understand what we mean by competitiveness. And that's a little bit tricky because competitiveness is something that is easy to define and well-defined for firms, but not so obviously for countries. So firms are competitive if they make large profits, they expand in markets, if they make profits, particularly when they are new and in markets where they have a competition. And, you know, the flavor of that is that not all firms in a given market can do well at the same time, right? So you do better, your competitor does worse, right? So in that sense, there is competition. Now, the thing that makes this term confusing in a country perspective is that countries are not in competition in the same way that firms are in competition. So what countries really should be worried about, what governments should be worried about, is growth and prosperity. And unlike market share, growth and prosperity are not zero-sum across countries. You know, one country doesn't become less prosperous because another country becomes more prosperous. And so, you know, economists very often worry that emphasizing competitiveness too much and using this analogy with firms is going to lead to counterproductive policies, to essentially policies that trying to, you know, improve economic conditions in one country by making them worse for another country. And that is definitely not true.
Oya, how does the IMF look at this topic?
First of all, thank you for having me. Delighted to be here. For us, competitiveness is quite similar to how Jeremy described it. We look at it at the country level. For us, what matters is a concept that we call external stability. So we look at whether the trade balances, to make things simple, trade balances of a country are at a reasonable level. So not very large deficit, which means countries are accumulating debt with the rest of the world, or too large surpluses where they're accumulating large claims on the rest of the world. Large deficits are unsustainable. Large surpluses mean that you're under-consuming and under-investing. So it's in that context that we look at competitiveness, and every country has imports, and the question is whether you're exporting enough, to make it simple, to pay for that import bill. Then we boil it down to relative costs of companies. As Jeremy said, it's not at the company level, but at the aggregate level. On average, are companies having reasonable relative costs to firms in other countries? And are they in sectors with high value added? So that's where you want to be. You want to have low relative costs. And then you want to be in market segments that are highly profitable and high value added. When we say relative costs, what begins to matter is relative productivity. So when you look at labor costs, for example, it's wages and the productivity of labor that matter. And wages, prices, those are market determined. Policy cannot influence it, but policy can begin to have an influence on productivity and efficiency.
German, how do we put the EU in the context of the rest of the world? Oya was just talking about surpluses and deficits. On the one hand, we have the US, which has run a big trade deficit for a long time. We've got China, which has run a big trade surplus for a long time. They're both also very concerned about competitiveness.
So one thing to note is that the EU as a whole has never had a competitiveness problem in the sense of having a large trade imbalance that would put external stability in doubt, right? So in this macroeconomic sense, there is no issue. Where the US has been better than the EU, and China and emerging markets have been better than the EU, is in the sense of the overall dynamism of an economy. So the way that I would define competitiveness is in terms of whether a country can establish conditions for high growth and more broadly prosperity in an international perspective. So countries should try to achieve good things for their citizens, and there is no sense in which they compete by doing that. But by comparing conditions across countries, one can detect whether countries are doing the best they can, right? So competitiveness in the sense of being good in relative terms helps you identify policies that you might want to work on. If you focus on the objective of competitiveness as raising living standards, then, traditionally the EU has had a tougher time than its competitors, for lack of a better word, than other countries, along maybe three or four dimensions. So the first one, the most obvious one, and the one that has gained a lot of prominence recently, is that we tend to have relatively high energy costs. So that makes it harder for our producers. A second one is we tend to have relatively high labor and social costs, and that has to do with high taxes, the costs of European welfare states. The third one is that, of course, and that's probably the most important one for me, the EU is not a single country, right? The EU is a collection of independent countries. And so, as an economic space, the EU is more fragmented. It lacks a common fiscal policy. It lacks deep common capital markets. And all those conditions means that it is harder for a firm to grow and operate in the EU than it would be for a firm to grow and operate in an economic area that is as large as the EU, but just is run by one single government. So these are sort of our traditional weaknesses, I would say. We also have had strengths. Social cohesion is higher in the EU than in other areas of the world. Inequality is lower in the EU. We don't face or have not traditionally faced quite the problems of political fragmentation that we face, or polarization that is the case now in the United States, for example. So those things make for better decision-making, better policies. Now, if you think about how to fix these things, I think that, even though you can make welfare states more efficient, the fact that we have large welfare states in the EU, which tend to be expensive, is largely a matter of political choice. So we cannot really do much about that unless we want to have high inequality. What we can do something about, but is hard, it requires a lot of coordination, is reducing energy costs within our physical and geographical conditions. So this is something we can probably talk about a little bit more. And then I think the main thing that we have to do more about is to reduce fragmentation. And so that requires essentially creating similar conditions across European countries that make it easier for firms to expand so they don't have to duplicate costs if they want to go from the national sort of confines to a more European level of operations. And along with that is the problem of, not being able to attract enough funding to really scale up in a very big way, which is probably the reason why we do not have the type of venture capital industry, for example, that we do have in the US. So I think this internal fragmentation is the fundamental issue with European competitiveness and the most important problem that we need to tackle. And it's a very old one. So this is essentially the of the European Union is that, apart from being a peace, And it was the big program of the Lisbon Treaty. And so it is, it's a hard slog. But I think, you know, given the challenges that we face, it's worth invigorating this agenda.
I want to come back to those fragmentation issues for sure. But to get into them, Oya, can you tell us how the IMF's work with the individual countries interacts with the work on the EU as a whole? And how do you see these spheres either working together or maybe having some room for improvement? Not the IMF's work, but the way the countries operate and their economic policies.
Mm-hmm. So we have consultations with each country in the EU, and then we also have a consultation where we look at common euro area policies. So these policies, of course, cover different areas. Jeremy mentioned a lot of policy areas where it's what you can do is at the EU level, lowering barriers, creating more of a financial union, a capital markets and banking union, etc. So those are EU-level policies, but we also have recommendations for countries at the country level relating to productivity, innovation, skills, etc. Maybe I would add to what Jeremy said in terms of EU's competitiveness, the fact that it's more fragmented than, say, the US, which is one country with one government, one language. So things are more complicated here. But at the end of the day, I think the fundamental issues for the EU, I would say, are productivity. Labor productivity has been, for a long time, lower, hasn't really caught up to the US. It seems like there's always a deficit. Of course, it's different from country to country within the EU. Some inability to stick to the technological frontier. Things are changing now. It's these digital firms in the digital sphere that are driving growth to a large extent. And there are no big champions in the EU. And then another trend that I think we have to think about is demographics. Europe is more advanced in terms of aging, and there is a labor scarcity and skill scarcity issue that we also have to think about.
How much would you say that productivity shortfall is directly related to the lack of technological champions and the lack of technological adaptation? I mean, is it just a question of as the technology gets more integrated in society, it will become more productive, or are there other things going on?
That's a complicated question, but it's productivity is about doing things in new ways. So adopting new technologies and bring labor, capital, other inputs together more productively. And it's also about innovating, actually creating those innovations. So those things are, at the end of the day, linked to the productivity of all the factors, including labor.
Thanks very much. When we come back, we'll talk more about the fragmentation in the EU and also what might be able to be done about it. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. In our next section, I would love to get more into some of the national factors affecting what can be done at the EU level. Chairman, you're based in Brussels with Bruegel. How do you see these national politics affecting what the EU can do to reduce some of these barriers?
So the fundamental problem that we have in the EU is that in order to become more productive, we need to expand markets to the EU scale. We need to coordinate policies across the EU. We need to particularly coordinate investments when it comes to the green transition, to the energy transition, to getting new renewable energy sources, creating electricity grids. But at the same time, our planning instruments, our fiscal resources, and of course, our political accountability are all or mostly at the national level, right? So at the end, governments will be judged by their national constituencies on their success. And so they have to deliver for those constituencies, no matter whether they get the right cooperation by other governments or not. And so that is why we have common European institutions to ameliorate that problem and generate that cooperation. Now, as it turns out, there are, you know, many areas where that cooperation still does not go far enough within the context of our current institutions. And just to give you sort of two examples, one would be on energy policy. You know, every country has to formulate, is formulating a national energy plan that must be consistent with European Green Deal goals. So we have coordinated, we are coordinated on how much we want to decarbonize in Europe. But the tools to do so, the policies, are largely at the national level. And so each country sits down and thinks, you know, I'm going to need so much renewable energy through solar and wind, and I'm going to use some geothermal, and I'm going to, you know, invest here, and I will make sure that there's a grid that transports electricity from the producing areas to the consuming areas. And this is all, for the most part, national. Now, we could really lower electricity costs a lot if we were to do the same exercise at a European scale, because at a European scale, we have much bigger differences in geography and natural resources that we can exploit, right? So the sun is in the south, the wind is in the north. If we can trade electricity from these various sources across all of Europe, it's really going to reduce cost. It's going to make the system more resilient and less volatile. And so this is one of the areas where, you know, stronger coordination would be good. So we have interconnected electricity markets, but fundamentally they are still separate markets. One issue of, you know, making this coordination easier is that even if things are way more efficient by doing this together, it could still be that there's some countries that might be worse off or feel they have less control in such a big plan. And so this is one of the reasons why we need common funding. So the common funding can ensure that in the end, everyone is better off. Another area where this type of cooperation could help is in industrial policy. So there are some areas where pushing innovation in the right direction, making sure that we expand or maintain comparative advantage in areas of manufacturing where we are strong, may require state subsidies for particular technologies that we think are promising. Now, that type of activity at this point is all done at the national level. And the problem with that is that big governments that have a lot of money have more scope to help their firms and push this than governments with less money. And so this is really bad for one of the most important things about the EU, namely that our firms compete on a level playing field. Competition within Europe is essential for European growth. It helps firms innovate, and that competition can be upset if some governments help their firms more than others. So it would be a really good idea to pull some of this type of policy more to the European level.
Thank you for bringing those threads out and how national interests and national funding sources really change things. Well, yeah, has the IMF estimated roughly how much money Europe should be investing? And I don't know if you break it down by public versus private, national versus EU. You know, I know the World Bank has made some estimates on the types of funding that might be necessary. Where do you come down?
So investment needs, we are soon to come with some numbers of our own for the green transition, which are not going to be so different than what the Commission has estimated. If I remember correctly, $4 trillion over 10 years is a number, and some of it has to be public, some of it private. I would say that I very much agree with what Jeremy mentioned about a need for EU-level funding, some pooling of resources to go about the green transition. So it's a common goal for the EU to lower emissions. It's a common goal to become more energy efficient and be less dependent on importing energy. And each country A and country B can both spend, let's say, 5 euros and to abate carbon. But it's the case that abating carbon, the cost of it is quite different across countries, depending on what their starting point is. So if you actually pool the resources and do it in the country, where the abatement cost is lower, you're going to achieve much more. But countries are going about this at a country-by-country level. So there's an efficiency argument for pooling resources. There's also an argument because some of the infrastructure is cross-border and you can only do it with cooperation. You need to do it together. And you also have the fact that borrowing costs are quite different across countries and fiscal space is different. So it makes much more sense to act on it together. Innovation, again, Jeremy mentioned that it's something that the market doesn't provide enough innovation on its own. It's an area that can benefit from some public intervention in general, but also we badly need it now for the green transition. So why not, again, it's an area very ripe for funding, some government funding. But again, it would be much more efficient to do it in a pooled manner, to a large extent, to preserve the level playing field and be more efficient overall.
So I've been making the argument at Bruegel and elsewhere that public debt can be a public good. Where do you come down on more joint borrowing and possibly permanent borrowing at the EU level?
It's along the lines that I just mentioned. Right now, of course, we had the NGEU in response to the pandemic, but we don't have a more permanent capacity. And we think that's lacking as part of the fiscal architecture.
Chairman, that is about as ringing an endorsement as careful folks in Washington are likely to make for permanent EU debt. How do we get the member states to agree that this is a good thing? There's still a lot of skepticism that making NGE permanent is the right thing to do.
I think the only way is to make the efficiency case for it, right? So you cannot start with the financing side. You have to start with what are you going to spend the money on and why is this good for everyone? And that is an easy argument to make in general terms, but it is then maybe difficult to provide the reassurance that in the end, this system is going to make each individual member state better off. And unfortunately, we need that because from a legal point of view, moving to common borrowing for the EU budget, while it is possible under the treaty, so we have published an extensive legal analysis on this last September to legal scholars, Sebastian Grund and Armin Steinbach wrote this. It's a policy brief. What it is in principle possible under the treaty to do that, you need unanimity. The reason you need unanimity is because there is an implementing a legal framework called the own resources decision that requires unanimity to be amended. And you basically need to say, we hereby declare proceeds from debt issuance to be an own resource. And we simultaneously identify sources of revenue that can service that debt. So that is essential from a legal point of view. You cannot just go into debt. You have also to say how you're going to pay for it. And to the extent that you need to say exactly what sort of revenues are going to be there to cover the debt service in every year. So it's a pretty high standard. And what makes it difficult is that the revenues that you need to identify for debt repayment, of course, they come out of a common pool that, for the most part, is already being used, right? It's the economy of the European Union, and for the most part, this is a pool from which traditionally only the member states have fished, right? So the member states traditionally get revenue, and then they pass on some of that to finance the EU budget. The EU itself also has some revenues, so for example, from customs duties, but it's a very small part. And so the difficulty is then to persuade member states to give up some of this revenue in order to be able to finance a common debt. And that only works if they're very, very clearly better off. So you need to make the case with every sort of area of spending that you're putting on the table. I personally think that, in the area of energy and climate, it's where the case is easiest and also where the pressures are highest. And then the other area, like I said, is probably some sort of industrial policy that you may want to use to promote particularly green technology. Because here, the current EU laws, and particularly what's known as the state aid framework, poses very strong restrictions on what member states can subsidize. There have been attempts to loosen it, but you know, the smaller member states are really not happy about those attempts. And so, you know, the obvious solution to that is to make some of this state aid available under on the European level, subject to very strong safeguards, so it's not misused.
It's a great point that for every debt, there needs to be a tax plan or some other way to bring in money to maintain it and keep it sustainable. We did a whole podcast on this last year with Pascal Saint-Amand, also a fellow at Bruegel and the Commission's Benjamin Angèle. It's really worth a listen, listeners out there, if you're interested in how this stuff works. Oya, I would love to ask you to tell us more about different sectors. We're seeing a lot about European farmers in the news right now. We talked about tech already. We're talking now about industry, manufacturing. Are there things specific to those sectors that we should be thinking about in this competitiveness conversation?
What comes naturally to me is manufacturing, because much of the traded goods in general around the world are manufactured goods. Of course, you have commodities as well, agricultural or natural resources, but manufacturing is a very interesting area to think about in the case of the EU. We've looked at this to some degree, and it's not only a manufacturing hub, but an innovation hub as well. So I think that's where some of the interesting questions are in terms of how the EU deals with geopolitical fragmentation. What will be the right approach for the EU, given that it's an ecosystem for both innovation and manufacturing? I don't know if that answers your question.
It's a really helpful way to get started thinking about it. Jeremy, would you like to add to that?
So I agree that it makes sense for the EU to look to maintain and further its strength in manufacturing. But we have to be mindful of two things. One is that manufacturing is likely to shrink as a source of employment and as a share of value added in the EU, simply because developing countries and emerging markets get better at it. And that is the way economic history works. So more advanced economies tend to have smaller manufacturing sectors, bigger services sectors. And it is not true that this then means that they will grow more slowly. So the United States, which we often envy, has been shrinking its manufacturing sector much faster than Germany, for example. And still it has done as well or even better than Germany on economic growth. The other thing we have to remember is that it's very hard to predict and for the state to promote in which direction manufacturing will develop. So we have this general instinct that we should replace brown manufacturing jobs with green manufacturing jobs, and that maybe an essential part of that is to promote clean technology. So this is certainly true. But what is unclear is whether that general direction requires state support or state guidance beyond the state guidance that we are already providing by making it clear that the direction of travel is decarbonization and by making brown technologies more expensive through carbon pricing. We are also providing guidance by having quite large subsidies in renewable energies. So those existed actually in Europe before the US now is starting to introduce them. And so we are creating demand, particularly for products that, you know, satisfy the needs of renewable energy, which are precisely clean tech products. So whether or not we should subsidize these products is not clear. So I would say that before the United States came with the Inflation Reduction Act, where they offered large-scale subsidies for production in these areas, actually, the consensus in Europe was we don't need to subsidize them because these are the growth sectors that everyone wants to invest in any case. So the big challenge for us is now that since not only China, but also the US has moved to a large-scale subsidies approach to basically increase their share of the global manufacturing pie, to what extent should we follow them? And you know, my view on that is that we should have these types of instruments in areas that are at the cutting edge, where we, by innovating, by being the first it can be particularly dynamic, create more jobs, have firms, European firms, temporarily make larger profits. And we should do this in areas which are essential for our economic or national security. But we should not try to defend manufacturing shares in technologies which have become more standard, like solar panels, for example, and where there is just an overwhelming cost advantage from producing these technologies outside the EU, whether or not these cost advantages come from subsidies or not. I mean, these are areas where, you know, the green transition really requires making investment as cheap as possible. And so in that sense, we should be happy about the fact that China produces some of these technologies very cheaply and, you know, uses its resources as a country to do so. It is not clear to me that, you know, either China or the United States will in the long run be able to afford, in a fiscal sense, providing these enormous subsidies. And, you know, while they do it, we should import them. We should use those products while at the same time defending our technological leadership in areas that are at the cutting edge of development.
When we come back, we'll hear more about ways to address competitiveness going forward. Oya, can you tell us what the IMF is recommending for Europe?
Sure. It has a lot to do with what we discussed in the beginning about fragmentation within the EU. So how to become a more integrated union is the question. So there are things that Europe can do in terms of strengthening the single market for goods and services. In financial markets, the capital completing making progress with capital markets and banking unions. Just in general, taking a more common approach to subsidies and taxes, and what we discussed about EU-level funding for toward common goals, toward common investments. I think those are the areas. It's a strong, large single market, but still there are barriers. There are border effects, border infrastructure effects that make trade costly within the EU. There are barriers for people still to move around because pensions are not portable or certifications are not easy to get acknowledged in different countries. Things of that nature, knowledge diffusion, it's not the same everywhere. Procurement contracts, you always have an advantage in your home country and there is not much cross-border competition. And when you look at the literature, you see analysis that look at, okay, how much do we gain if we lower these barriers? And you see pretty large numbers. Of course, academic research is always biased towards finding positive results rather than the other way around, but they are really large numbers, double-digit gains in terms of GDP sometimes you come across. So that's one big area. The next one is the capital markets union. Europe's financial system is very much bank-based, and that may not be the best setup for financing risky investments, which is what we need for more green innovation. So this has been a long-standing issue. Some progress has been made, but there's lots more that has to happen. Venture capital, Jeremy mentioned that there should be more venture capital in the EU to finance these fast-growing innovative firms, for example. What we see is that these types of firms end up getting listed in the US and then maybe moving there. How can Europe do better on that front? Those are some of the areas that we always talk about. Then the fragmentation in policymaking. You have the energy shock, and everybody has their own approach to subsidizing firms. There are windfall profits for banks. Everybody has their own way of taxing them. Probably a more unified way of going about those would help.
We have so many studies on this coming out right now. Mario Draghi is doing a report. Enrico Letta is doing a report. Bruegel has done many reports, all contributing to different angles of this. German, how do we take it forward?
So I think in two ways. The first is that with respect to these areas of common action, regulatory alignment, unions of both of various types, banking union, capital markets union, that we have been pushing for a long time and where we're not making much progress, there needs to be a more purposeful approach, particularly by the European Commission, to link our geopolitical challenges and our broad competitiveness challenge to progress in these areas. So we have to understand why we haven't done better in some of these areas that Oya mentioned. It's clear, for example, in the banking union, it has to do with the fact that, you know, fiscal responsibilities are at the member state level, that members are concerned about the distributional consequences of, say, common deposit insurance. So it is quite difficult to make progress without, you know, having a more common approach to use of funds. In other areas like capital markets union, it's less obvious. So this could have to do with resistance of national bureaucracy. It could have to do with special interests. And there may be an opportunity to make more progress by having stronger political leadership. And being under threat from China, being under threat from a more nationalist way of doing policy in the United States could be a way of, you know, breaking the logjam on some of these big projects. So this is the first dimension. And so here, you know, to be a little bit critical to the European Commission, I think that, you know, their instinct in response to the Inflation Reduction Act was to not go back to these longstanding issues, but rather, you know, try to invent new instruments, talk more about subsidies, talk more about industrial policy, which is not entirely wrong, but we have very weak instruments at the European level. And so I don't think that what has been done there in the last 12 months or so is going to, you know, create a lot of progress. So we need a more medium-term approach, one that goes back to the basics. So this is the first strand. The second strand is that given how difficult it is to overcome these fragmentation problems in the EU, we have to look for pragmatic ways of making the case for more cooperation that might work in the medium term. So even if capital market union stands still, even if banking union stand still, even if we cannot get sort of the next big push on regulatory alignment. And that would be to identify, you know, somewhat smaller pushes built around a particular aim or purpose. And so for me here, the big one is, for example, a common electricity market, where you can come up with an efficiency case that is very concrete. I mean, you can say, look, if we have a 10-year common investment approach, and accompany this with some policy reforms that are coordinated, that's going to lower our electricity costs by 30%. So in effect, you are taking much the same approach in that you are imposing an EU-wide view, but you're really breaking it down. You're making it concrete. You're making the gains transparent. And so I think this could exist in a few areas. And like I said, you know, a more common industrial policy might be another one.
That's really interesting. Certainly when we hear European industry groups themselves talk about this, they don't talk about subsidies so much as they talk about what they perceive to be really crushing levels of regulation. And hearing that from them at the same time that the EU is really trying to be at the vanguard of digital regulation and the vanguard of some of these regulations really shows, I would say, I mean, from here, it looks like two different paths that the EU is walking on, and sometimes it's hard to see how to reconcile them. Oya, is this something that the IMF is working on, and do you have recommendations there?
So we are macroeconomists. We don't get into the micro of regulation. Maybe I'll end with a question to Jeremy, but let me make a plug for simplifying certain rules relating to the green transition here. Permitting, for example, is an obstacle to ramping up renewables within the EU. This is a more of a country-by-country issue. At the EU level, there are initiatives to push towards easing that, of course, still by still preserving certain environmental and other legal standards. But we do see some areas, we focus on the green transition, for example, we do see some ways, some possibility to make it easier for companies to come and invest in those areas. But this overregulation question that you asked, Rebecca, I just wanted to ask Jeremy whether it may have anything to do, again, with the fact that this is about 27 countries trying to do things together and trying to build trust.
So maybe to first go back to Rebecca's point that there's this seeming contradiction of the EU trying to regulate more in some areas, and then in others, there's this broad consensus that we might be overregulated, right? So I agree with you. You put it very nicely. The way I would reconcile this is that we do have some areas that are moving very fast, where there's a lot of innovation, where there are potentially harmful effects or actual harmful effects that we can already see, particularly in the competition area, and where regulation has been used increasingly to substitute for slower and clunkier ways of maintaining competition, right? And that is particularly the Digital Markets Act. That was the idea. And I think these are very good, for the most part, regulatory attempts by the EU. They are also risky. They are good because they serve a very clear purpose, competition and consumer protection. We're going to need more of that regulation in the context of the AI revolution, for sure. And I don't think that the industry is necessarily opposed to it. You know, Mark Zuckerberg has called for more regulation of the internet, for example. By being first, I think the EU can also exercise a competitiveness advantage, because if you're the first to regulate and you regulate a very big market, then the rest of the world may copy your regulation. So that is one area. The other area is, and here, you know, Oya is absolutely right that, you know, clearly we are overregulating, or we are being unnecessarily bureaucratic in many areas that basically, I think, have to do with the fact that local authorities that regulate do not fully internalize the benefits of regulating less. So, you know, as a local authority, you're worried about a particular environmental standard, worried about a particular safety standard. You're not so much worried about the dynamism of firms in the EU as a whole. You're worried more about the downsides in general than the upsides, right? And so here, I should say this particularly because I was critical of the Commission, you know, the attempt of the Net Zero Industry Act, which was a law that was just passed to encourage the development of green tech in Europe, and which we have criticized at Bruegel because, you know, it lacks some of these sort of strong central elements of industrial policy that we would like to have, and because in its original form it also took a somewhat mechanical approach to what was being promoted and what was not being promoted. In spite of all this criticism, one has to recognize that what the Commission here is trying to do is to essentially create pressure on member states to reduce some of these regulatory barriers, and particularly on cutting on permitting times. And so that is completely well taken, and they should continue to keep up the pressure in this regard.
Oya, do you have any closing thoughts for us?
Well, the thoughts are, again, about productivity, innovation, building labor skills. We didn't talk so much about labor, but I think we've been so distracted with multiple crises, global financial crisis, pandemic, etc., that we forgot that a big demographic shift is approaching. We will soon go from having slightly growing working age populations to shrinking ones. We should also think about that and what it will mean for productivity and for competitiveness.
Thank you both so much for coming on the show today. We are discussing European and global competitiveness with Oya Celazun from the International Monetary Fund, Jeremy Zettelmeyer, Director of Bruegel. I'm Rebecca Christie from Bruegel. I also write a Europe column for Reuters Breaking Views. You can find all of the Bruegel reports and things that we've discussed here on our website, bruegel.org, and we hope you'll join us next time. Thanks for listening.